About 1:05, apologize for being started late. We'll start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 363.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 363A, A in gross, comes to you. It primarily deals with the lottery issues. This one in particular talks about disclosure requirements. This is when it comes to the retailers of what they disclosed and what could be waived from this disclosure requirement. This bill, or a similar bill close to it, was passed in the 2001 session. Then it was Senate Bill 374. However, it was a slightly in a different format. It gave most of this waiver of disclosure to the director of the lottery. And I guess because of that, it was vetoed by the governor that it gave too much discretion to the directors. Or too much weight to the director's discretion. Now, this one allows the commission to, lottery commission that is, to make that waiver after the director makes a recommendation for that. Those puts it in three new different categories. You have it in your SMS. Towards the background, in the middle of the page, on 1, 2, 3, of the directors who own or control 3% or more percent of voting stock, stockholders of more than 10%, and general partners or LLCs, joint ventures. And in that, it's all about the disclosure and regulation of the lottery, and it doesn't have revenue or fiscal impact.
Thank you, Mazin. Colleagues, in your packets, you've got a letter from Director Dale Pym of the Oregon Lottery Commission indicating that they believe that this bill is an effective tool to address changing corporate ownership while maintaining appropriate security safeguards. I understand that the Oregon State Police are okay with this bill as it has been amended, and it's my understanding that these provisions mirror the OLCC's issues for the required disclosure. So with that, Bill Perry, welcome. Sign in for the record, please.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Association. And as it's been described, this is a bill that deals with a disclosure, and right now to get a liquor license I have to disclose all my business partners to the OLCC, and then the OLCC will basically do a background check on anybody who has any operational concerns if they're going to be coming into the process day to day, or family members that might be involved. But if somebody's just a silent partner that loaned me, say, $5,000, they may waive that disclosure as a cost-cutting measure, but I still have to disclose the financial interest. The lottery does not have an ability to waive these interests, and so if somebody loans me money, I not only have to disclose them, but the state police have to go out and actually do an extensive background check on everybody that has any ownership interest. It happens a few times in mine, but Brian Daugherty, who testified on the Senate, was unable to be here, and a kind of an extreme example was ConocoPhillips, who wants the traditional machines in their gas stations, was actually 9% of their stock was bought by the Templeton funds, and so then under the law they would have to go in and research all the different shareholders or board members for Templeton funds when they're really not going to have any operational issues. So this will allow us either on a big or small basis to be able to save some time and cost at the lottery.
Thank you very much, Bill. We appreciate you bringing this bill back. I think this has been long overdue that we need to start to mirror the lottery and the OLCC requirements for signing up for these kinds of things. And as I say, this is long overdue, and we appreciate it. Questions of Bill? Hearing and seeing none, thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, we will, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing, open the work session. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 363A in gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
You heard the motion discussion. Is there any objection to the motion? Representative Comp is excused. For the record, please make note. And with that, colleagues, hearing no objection, we will move House Bill, or Senate Bill 363 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It was amended in the Senate. There's no objection of any of the parties here. Any objection to this moving to the consent calendar?
I would prefer an explanation. Okay. I'm not a big fan of the consent.
Okay, you're not a consent calendar fan. Okay. I think we have a carrier. Representative Berger, would you carry the commissioner out? Thank you very much. With that, we will close the work session on 363, Senate Bill as A and Gross. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 840.
Keep it short.
Okay.
I just want to know, Mr. Chair, that you'd be much better with three-digit numbers.
You know what? I'm not very good with numbers, Representative Riley.
Yeah.
There you go.
On that note, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that note.
Senate Bill 840, it's in many ways an enabling legislation. This is... today, under current law, wine manufacturers have to submit a monthly statement, and that monthly statement, whether or not they have any obligation to pay the or owe privilege tax. This bill will allow the ones who are not expected to owe any privilege tax to file, instead of monthly, file it annually. This bill was also amended in your committee in the Senate to change it from the fiscal year into a calendar year basis. And I think that is more conducive to the business climate and also the OLCC.
Thank you very much. And it's my understanding that Senate Bill 840 also mirrors the federal exemption for wineries that qualify for Oregon's small winery tax exclusion. Colleagues in this committee in the past, we've tried to make sure that where a federal level was reached, that we try and move the state levels to mirror the same as much as we possibly could on these kinds of issues. So with that, Gary, would you like to add to the testimony that you provided in writing to the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Gary Conkling, appearing here today on behalf of the Oregon Wine Growers Association in support of Senate Bill 848. I think actually the explanation is fairly complete. I might note that there are probably more than 200 small wineries that produce less than 40,000 gallons per year, which is the threshold in Oregon for the tax. And many of them today, to the extent that they report on a monthly basis, some do, some don't, they're supposed to, usually report zero. That's because many small wineries, when they bottle, take their wine out of bond at that point, so they have 1 month during the year where they actually would have some number other than zero. What this bill does is sort of recognize that reality and allow them, as they do under the federal system, to report once a year. And I might add, it has no revenue impact, and it has, if anything, only a slightly positive fiscal in that it reduces the OLCC's workload as well as ours in terms of the paperwork.
Thank you very much, Gary. Questions of either staff or Mr. Conkling? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 840 and open a work session on Senate Bill 840. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 840 as engrossed to the House with a due pass recommendation.
You've heard the motion. Discussion on the motion. Now, Representative Berger is right in the middle of wine country here, and those 200 small wineries that Mr. Conklin referred to are mostly in your district. So,
well, or nearby.
Very close.
I just like to drink it.
Okay, I'll carry it. I'm happy to carry it.
I wasn't going to say that, Representative.
I'll carry it, and I'll be very, very brief.
Okay.
Okay.
For the record, Representative Haas needed to be in the Speaker's office, and Representative Comp is excused to testify in another committee. Colleagues, other than that, we're all present accounted for. No further discussion. Is there any objection to moving this bill to the House with the due pass recommendation? The motion is to move it to the House with the due pass recommendation. Hearing and seeing no objections, So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
With your permission, I would like to carry this.
Oh, okay. Terrific.
See, we found someone else that enjoys the product, too.
Just be brief. There's a lot of wineries in Washington County.
Wonderful. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. And small ones, too?
Now you bet.
Because this will be a great benefit for them. Okay.
At the time of the Senate hearing, they all brought little samples, Mr. Chair. I don't know.
Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Mr. Chair, will you take a reconsideration?
with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 840. Representative Riley will carry that. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 32. Deborah, you're welcome to come forward if you'd like.
Chairman Butler and committee members, with Senate Bill 32, this is one of the two Department of Revenue bills that you have on the agenda today. And so this is providing the Department of Revenue the authority to establish rules to waive penalties on taxpayers for good and sufficient cause that results to the incident being the first offense for the taxpayer. It allows the Department of Revenue the authority to establish rules to waive penalties so that the actions will enhance the long-term effectiveness, efficiency, or administration of the tax system. So basically, under current law, Department of Revenue has the authority to waive or reduce a taxpayer's tax owed, the interest and penalties assessed, or the total tax up to a dollar amount of $50, but if the taxpayer can demonstrate good and sufficient cause. So right now, under current law, that's what we're changing. Is the kind of the definition of good and sufficient cause. The Department of Revenue rule, which defines good and sufficient cause, specifies that the details are for good and sufficient cause for waiving those taxes penalties and do not make allowances under current law, under their rule, for taxpayers' first-time tax return offense. So basically, this is allowing the Department of Revenue that ability, if it is a taxpayer's first-time offense, to include that in their waiver under good and sufficient cause. So basically, with the revenue impact, it may reduce revenue slightly, but it would definitely be only a minimal amount, less than $50,000 each year.
Elizabeth, what's your understanding of how these waiver opportunities and waiver establishment of rule for waiver reduction compromise the penalties would be affected under Senate Bill 480 as passed that through the Senate?
Chairman Butler, the Senate discussed both of these at the same time, and they really felt like this would still be in play at the same time you would have Senate Bill 480.
So they felt that good and sufficient cause was other than any kind of attempt to reduce taxes then.
That's right. And these first-time offenses was something that an example was brought up by Senator George in the Senate committee about just there could be, he knew of a taxpayer who just didn't know about this certain type of legal change, and so, he didn't file correctly, and it was a first-time offense of this taxpayer. So that's the kind of example the Department of Revenue could, establish then under good and sufficient cause a waiver of any penalties for interest they didn't know about.
Thank you, Deborah, for this great presentation. Please enter and sign in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. As staff explained, this is adding two criteria to the existing penalty waiver statute. Currently, we can waive penalty on a finding of good and sufficient cause. An example might be if there's been a death in the family of the taxpayer and they're unable to file timely, or if there's been destruction of the tax records. In that case, there's good and sufficient cause for waiver of a penalty. But when you have a person who has filed timely for 20 years and then 1 year they simply forget to do their filing for no good reason, it doesn't seem that there is authority in the statute to waive penalty in that case. If that person came in and said, this is the first time I've ever done that, I would appreciate you waiving the penalty for me, we would be able to do that under this statute. Another example is in situations where we believe that it would enhance the long-term effectiveness of the system if we were able to waive penalty. For example, in situations where people have not filed returns for 6 years, and the penalties, the tax, the interest is so huge that they simply are unable to come into the system and pay everything that they owe because of the monetary burden, and they ask for some waiver. In that case, we believe that it might be more effective to get them back into the system, get them right with us and filing returns in the future, and penalty waiver in that case would be an enhancement.
So, Deborah, if I could just ask, and this is something that did happen in the Fraser Valley, so I need to be very cautious about it, but it was a public record. A doctor, a local physician, was duped into investing in a tax shelter. These folks told him that, first of all, it would lower his income tax, and second of all, it would increase his cash flow, and he invested very significant amounts into it, and found out that it was nothing more than a glorified tax shelter, and was the vendors of it were eventually imprisoned. I have then a person who is now involved in a tax shelter and owes virtually millions of dollars in income tax on an annual income of around $400,000, and with the penalties, he's lost his medical license in the process. So tell me how this would play out in Senate Bill 480 with the ability of the department. I don't want to lose him off the tax rolls, but by the same token, I mean, at best, what I'm going to have is probably he'll go to an Indian reservation and become emergency doctor.
Mr. Chairman, as staff mentioned, there was discussion in the Senate committee about this bill and its provisions, and the Senate Revenue Committee amended this language into Senate Bill 480 and provided direction to the department that in administering that voluntary compliance initiative and the amnesty program, that we would take into account these provisions.
Still have that latitude.
To be able to waive penalty. Excellent. In certain situations.
Okay. Other questions of Deborah or Elizabeth? Yes, Representative.
What about federal? Would you know if they'd broken the law at the federal level? Oops.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, we do receive information from the IRS as to adjustments that they have made to tax returns and also to individuals participating in listed transactions or abusive tax shelters, so we do get some information.
So if somebody had, for six straight years, not complied with federal tax law, but it was the first time in Oregon, what would the decision be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, I'm not sure. I think it would depend on all the facts. Generally, I think it's fairly safe to say that they're more likely to be filing with federal and perhaps not filing with the state, then they would be filing with the state and not filing with the federal.
It's been my experience, Deborah, and for Representative Galizio's edification, that the Department of Revenue is much easier to work with on those kinds of circumstances you just mentioned than is the Department of Revenue. Now, the Department of Revenue is easier to work with than the Internal Revenue Service. They're frequently, it almost takes an act of Congress to get those folks to budge on some issues, and they're very unyielding, and I've got, for instance, that large case from that cattle feeding operation in Harney County. The director has said, just get the IRS to sign off and we'll close those cases. Kids that were working in high school and got sucked into that thing with their high school wages that are now forever barred from holding property in their name in any state as a result of the fact that their summers were spent working on the ranch and their wages were treated as part of a investment into a tax-sheltered limited partnership. And they didn't know. And so I'd love to have the IRS sign off on it. But they think that there's somehow, with the lives in being, that they're going to collect maybe $100 or $200. They're willing to keep those people in the underground economy, or to have their spouses or family members own their assets for the rest of their lives, so that they'll never own one does a really an excellent job in a trucking business, but his wife has to own the trucks. He can't get insurance. He can't. I mean, it's almost impossible for him to conduct business. So it's a shame. And again, the director, Director Archenko, has said, you know, we'd love to close these cases, but that isn't the worst of your concerns, because it's the Fed that can come in and nail them once they have anything in their name. So thank you very much. Other questions? Okay. Thank you. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 32 and open a work session on Senate Bill 32.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 32 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
The motion is to move Senate Bill 32 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion being made? For the record, Representative Hass is away at a meeting. Representative Comp is in a hearing in another part of the building. Representative Esquivel is excused. Any objection to the motion to move 32 to the House with Senate Bill 32 to the House with a due pass recommendation? Hearing and seeing no objection, we'll show that that is carried. We will close the. Let's see.
I'd be happy to.
We'll start at the far end down there. Let's give that one to.
Did you get the next one? I like this idea.
I'd be honored.
Representative Olson? Representative Olson will carry this one. We'll close the work session on House Bill, or Senate Bill 32. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 33. I need to have you first tell me why we had so many no votes over on the Senate side on that. Just not understand
it? Yeah. Chairman Butler, to be honest, you know, yeah, I don't really remember this debate. Maybe Deborah does, but, you know, basically this was another Department of Revenue bill, and we didn't have any opposition that I remember at all on the actual vote in the Senate committee. Yeah. Just Senator Pruzanski was gone, but everybody was supporting it in the committee. But it was doing specifying that a taxpayer fails to file a report or return or pay a tax on time, the Department of Revenue shall add a 5% delinquency penalty on the amount of tax that is owed. And it clarifies that there will only be one 5% delinquency penalty assessed per return. It clarifies that the Department of Revenue can accept a notice of tax deficiency as a reason for not imposing a delinquency penalty of 5%, and it takes effect 90 days after the end of session. So basically, under current law, Department of Revenue, you know, has a tiered penalty system depending on when a taxpayer first pays. But this base 5% delinquency penalty is on the amount of tax that is shown on the tax return statement. Okay, and so instead of the amount that is actually owed. So that's one change that you're making in this bill, is you're just changing it so it's not the amount of tax that is shown on the tax statement, which could be wrong. So what they're doing is saying, if we find that there's a difference between the tax that is shown on the statement versus the tax that actually is owed, then there will be the penalty will be based on the amount that actually should be owed. So that's one distinction in this bill. Then this 5% delinquency penalty assessed when the taxpayer fails to pay the tax owed by the due date. And under current law, though, a taxpayer could be assessed more than one delinquency penalty on the tax return. And Deborah will go through an example like that. But that's one problem with current law. In addition, if the Department of Revenue issues a bill for additional tax owed, then the taxpayer does not pay the additional tax in 30 days, then they could have no penalty is charged. So you've got this inconsistency under current law where some taxpayers could have more than one delinquency penalty assessed and others may not have any penalty assessed. So basically what this bill is doing is clarifying the Department of Revenue will be placing one 5% delinquency penalty per tax return if it falls in that category. So basically, that's what the bill is doing. At the last year, under current law, there are few exceptions when the penalty for failing to file or pay a tax on time can be waived. And so then basically the penalty can be waived. If the taxpayer does one of the following, he either pays the full amount of the tax plus interest within 30 days of the due date, the taxpayer files an amended return and pays a portion of the tax that is owed plus interest, or the taxpayer has filed timely and there is a difference in the amount of the tax that is paid or before the due date as revealed in the taxpayer's tax return or the Department of Revenue records. So basically, as far as the you know, revenue impact, again, it's going to be minimal because there's just going to be a few tax returns, it, you know, actually would have a difference in the amount that is shown on their tax return versus how much they actually owed, and that was the basis then of the delinquent tax penalty.
So Elizabeth, if I understand mm-hmm. correctly, under the two examples, and we've been given a couple of examples mm-hmm. by Ms. Buchanan, if I think that I'm going to owe $500, and I could then go ahead and gin up a $500 rural medical tax credit or something like that, mm-hmm. stick that on my return, that would not subject me to the 5%. Currently, I wouldn't be subject to the $500 penalty because my penalty or my tax was wiped out on the face of the return.
Yeah, you wouldn't be subject to the delinquency penalty.
Right,
yeah.
I wouldn't be subject to this 5% delinquency right. penalty. But then, even with this bill, then what happens is the department has 30 days, or as soon as the department recognizes that I'm not really qualified for a $500 credit of any kind on the face of the return, and then they send me a bill. If I don't pay the bill within 30 days, then the 5% penalty occurs.
That's right.
Doesn't that in effect encourage people to try and figure out a way to insert some sort of a credit or a reduction? Reducing mechanism?
But Chairman Butler, under current law, they wouldn't get any penalty. So, I mean, we're this bill is moving us, at least in the direction of penalizing people who may be trying to just create.
So it doesn't create that penalty until after 30 days.
Right, but once the Department of Revenue determines that that is incorrect tax return. Okay. But it's just under current law, they're not even assessing a 5%.
Just assessing the tax.
That
plus
tax,
interest.
That's right.
What's the interest rate right now?
Oh, it depends, again, on when they pay it. So.
What's the interest mm-hmm. rate per annum?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I believe it's 6%, Mr. Chair. Simple interest.
Okay. That's a pretty cheap loan. All right. I'm sorry, Deborah. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Staff has done a very good job of explaining this. We are looking at this as an effort to provide consistent treatment for two groups of taxpayers. All of our penalties, well, I shouldn't say all of our penalties because I'll be proven wrong, but as a general rule, penalties are based on tax owed. If a person has unpaid tax, that would be the amount that's subject to penalty. If they have paid their tax in full, even if they're filing late, no penalties apply. What happens in this case is if I file my return on time and I show, as you described, Mr. Chair, $500 of tax due on the return, but I don't pay it, I am immediately assessed a 5% penalty for failure to pay the tax that I showed on the return. On the other hand, if I file the return and I don't show any tax owing, the department adjusts it and sends me a bill for $500, I will not be subject to any penalty on that tax, even if I choose not to appeal the adjustment and even if I don't pay it for 3 months, 5 months, 6 months, a year. No penalty will be applied. This bill would say that in that second situation where there is an adjustment and a billing of additional tax due, if the taxpayer doesn't either appeal the adjustment or pay it within 30 days, then the 5% penalty would apply. And, Mr. Chair, we did discuss at the department the situations that you described where people might be tempted to file a false return so that they're not owing any tax, and then they get an adjustment. But, again, we think those would be few and far between, and as staff pointed out, there is no penalty that would apply.
Is there a 25% penalty for failure or for filing a false return?
Mr. Chairman, the if we were able to prove that they filed a false and fraudulent return, the penalty, I believe, is 100%.
100% if it's...
There is, however, a penalty for failure to file if that failure extends for more than 3 months, and that's a 20% penalty.
I
so
see.
That would still apply if there's unpaid tax.
So, Deborah, if upon audit, and using the second of the two examples, Jane and Sam, that you've given us in your very appropriate handout here, if Sam is subsequently audited, and in the course of the audit we find out that Sam owes $500, and he fails to pay the $500 when billed, and he begins the process to say, I don't think he should have excluded my charitable, then that's an appeal, and so he's not subject to the 5%. But if he just fails to pay or respond to the audit request within 30 days, then Sam is going to pay an additional 5%?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
That's different. The IRS doesn't do that, do they?
I believe ours are structured a little bit differently than IRS.
So, Representative Esquivel.
I'm curious, and the reason I'm curious about these penalties is exactly how they do work, because if you get an extension, what I did last year, I think that my CPA turned in my payment stuff in July or whatever it was.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I had an extension. And then 2 months, 3 months after the fact, I received a letter from the revenue office stating that I owed a $770 penalty. And no explanation, just said you owe a $770 penalty. My accountant, I turned it over to him, say this is your job. So he calls up to your organization and they said, well, we don't know, but we'll get back to you. So in the interim, this is about 3 weeks goes by in this time frame, I get another letter from your office saying that they're going to have a warrant for my arrest. I don't even know what the penalty is. There was no explanation or anything. Is that normal procedure with your office?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, no, that would not be normal procedure. We should give you an explanation of what the penalties are and your appeal rights and what you can do next. The extension is an extension of time to file your tax return. It's not an extension of payment of tax. So when you get an extension, what you need to do is estimate the amount of tax you think you will owe and pay that by April 15th.
I don't know. That's up to my accountant.
Right? Oh, there's some guys out here in blue uniforms.
That's right.
Right.
And I was kind of worried about is having Representative Olson knocking at my door is my real concern. But
moonlighting, are you now?
I did not receive an explanation, is what I'm telling you, for that $770 penalty that we didn't know what it was.
Here he comes.
Here he comes.
There he goes. I wear a blue uniform. He's after you. Deborah, I appreciate the fact that isn't standard operating procedures. And there is occasionally a bill that comes in the mail that we'll see from a taxpayer that they say, we really don't know what this is. But within a matter of minutes, normally, we can find that out. It would be probably your accountant's procedure to, at the time you filed your return, to have had you sign a power of attorney to communicate with the service, or immediately upon your presentation to them of the billing and them not knowing what the billing was, to have you sign a power of attorney to be able to immediately communicate, and then within a matter of minutes they can know by faxing the power of attorney over exactly what it is. I mean, you forgot, or somewhere in the mail, the first notice was lost, saying that this was a penalty based upon failure to estimate your taxes, or we didn't get the carryover of the prior tax credit off the return correct. Or there's a whole series of things that it could have been. But I think standard procedure is that you will have, I mean, with the first time that there's a balance due on a return, there's at least a half a dozen numbers, including two or three codes, that show you exactly what it is that they're sending. Now, if you've missed the first letter for whatever reason, then the second letter is pay up. Very shortly thereafter, it's pay up or we'll take your firstborn. So
was that then I said, you can have him.
Was that after you'd been appointed to the senator? Is it the Senate?
Yes, it was.
There
you go. Because I was in the Senate. Now I get it.
But that would be far outside the normal customary procedure in that process, has been my experience. And even when that happens, even when you do miss that first mailing for whatever reason, the department is excellent to work with for yourself or other professionals to be able to send in powers of attorney and then all of a sudden be able to communicate with real people over the real problems. They're excellent in that regard. But I guess I am concerned that this basically takes us a step away from where we are with the Internal Revenue Code right now, and that is to have a $500 tax shown with a $25 penalty, or to have an audit. And in this particular case, this is exactly the case that you would have here. No reference to the first letter. The second letter is, we're coming to get your firstborn, or to arrest you for, you know, the standard letter I can see how you might think that it was an arrest letter, but the concern is that you would owe the 5% penalty on top of the $700. And that's as a result, and I'm assuming that it's a tax, that's a tax shortfall in that process. If it was a penalty for failure to estimate your taxes properly, then that's 5% penalty. This is the penalty on the tax due, not having to do with any of the other penalties or failures.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The penalty only applies to unpaid tax.
Unpaid
tax. Tax that was due on April 15th and was not paid on that date. But, Mr. Chair, could I just address your concern about the disconnect with the federal provisions?
Please.
10 years ago, I believe, is where we got into the situation that we have now. And what we were doing then was looking at the federal requirements and thinking that those were perhaps somewhat onerous, because the penalty that applied under the IRS rules was for the tax that was required to be shown on the return. So if you filed your return and you made a mistake and it was required to show $1,000 and you showed zero, the penalty would apply to the $1,000. And when you filed it, you had no idea that you were making a mistake. We looked at that and said that seems to be somewhat punitive. At least you should give them a chance to know that they owe additional tax before you apply a penalty. I think that's how we headed down the road that we are now, where we cannot apply the penalty even if they choose not to pay it for 6 months. So we already have some disconnect from the federal provisions. This would move us a little closer by at least saying there will be a penalty that applies at some point.
So the federal has a penalty for filing a tax return with a zero tax due when you do, in fact, later as shown in audit, though, $1,000.
Yes.
What is that penalty?
I believe it is a 5% penalty for failure to pay the tax required to be shown on the return. Because if you show that you owe zero, you're obviously not going to pay anything.
Right.
So you were required to put $1,000 on there. You put nothing on there. The penalty would apply to the $1,000 that was required to be shown on the return. And I believe it's a 5% failure to pay penalty.
Okay. And so in that regard, we really do come closer to the federal.
A bit closer, Mr. Chair, but we're not quite as punitive, because we give them a chance to pay it before the
30
penalty
days.
Applies. Yeah. We say, this is what you owe, and then they can say, no, I don't owe it, or yes, I owe it, and here's the money, and pay it without penalty.
And if the tax return showed zero tax due, but in fact, on audit, it was $1,000, and they had $1,000 prepaid that they asked to just go ahead and apply to the ongoing estimates, what happens then?
There would be no tax due and no penalty applied.
Okay. Right. Further questions of Deborah? I'm still a little bit troubled on this. Representative Esquivel, will you look into some of these issues, please?
Yes, sir, I shall.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Deborah. Other questions of staff? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 33. We'll bring Senate Bill 33 back for a work session with a report from Senator Esquivel and a full briefing on what he did with the errant $740.
I paid it. I didn't want to get arrested. I didn't want Representative Olson at my house.
We'll hear the rest of the story at a later time. Any other business for the good of the order? With that, colleagues, we'll close revenue for the day. Thank you very much.
Yes.